Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments. Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, October 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, QFCC.com. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Sven Hida of Albany Medical College. Dr. Hida is a board-certified gastroenterologist specializing in advanced interventional endoscopy, digestive and swallowing disorders, as well as intestinal, pancreatic, and liver cancers. Get in line now. Call us. It will be a popular program. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Sven Hida, it's a Medical Monday. Your calls, your emails, coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Sven Hida, a board-certified gastroenterologist. Dr. Hida serves as the Director of Endoscopy Services and the head of the Section of Interventional Endoscopy at Albany Med's Digestive Disease Center. He treats patients for a full range of GI diseases and disorders that includes intestinal, pancreatic, and liver cancers, pancreatitis, gastroparesis, Barrett's esophagus, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, irritable bowel syndrome, and many others. Dr. Hida received his medical degree from the St. George's University School of Medicine in Grenada, West Indies. He completed his residency and fellowships in internal medicine and gerontology at Winthrop University Hospital in lovely Mineola, New York. Now perhaps the apex of his career, he's a guest on Medical Monday. Dr. Sven Hida, it's downhill from here, clearly. This is it. You've reached the top. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551 if you want to get in. I would suggest you do so early. These shows tend to be pretty popular, and we always end up leaving somebody on the line. You can also email us, and I will check periodically the email, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. Before we get to the phones, I see this bit about advanced interventional endoscopy. I've had an endoscopy. They put a camera down my throat. They checked out my esophagus. Ooh, that's diagnostic, right? Or that's not really interventional. What's interventional about endoscopy?
So interventional about endoscopy really has to do with surgical procedures that are done with the scope after diagnosis is made, biopsying of cancers beyond the walls that we can see with procedures such as endoscopic ultrasound, ERCP, spyglass, and then performing actual surgeries like pyloromyotomies, heliromyotomies, which are really muscular incisions that we make in the esophagus and the stomach to relieve certain conditions.
So this is a way to be less invasive when you do these surgeries?
Absolutely. That is what I am trying to bring to Albany Medical Center, which is less intrusive procedures, exactly. Minimally invasive, really.
So, I mean, most of the time you hear of the conventional way of doing things. How popular now is what you do?
Well, I think the whole movement in gastroenterology is toward minimally invasive procedures because so much really can be done with the scope just through the mouth, which is a natural orifice. And most of these procedures really involve very specialized equipment that is used through these scopes in order to perform these procedures. So it is the future of endoscopy.
Dr. Sven Hida is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Kathy in Albany. Kathy, you're on.
Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
I actually had an endoscopy as well and determined that while I do not have Barrett's, I do have some acid reflux. I've been chewing omeprazole for a bit, and because of the long-term side effects, I'm looking to see if there are other non-medicinal or other kinds of actions that I should be taking.
Hi, Kathy. Yes. Well, once medical management has been maximized, and I'm not just discussing acid reflux, but also bile reflux. So if you have been able to be treated for both of those conditions unsatisfactorily, and you're still having issues with acid reflux or reflux and heartburn related type of symptoms, then we do offer something called transoral incisionless fund application, which is a surgical procedure done through the scope, again, minimally invasive, and it is an excellent alternative to Nissen fund applications and other open surgical procedures that can be done.
Okay, and if the omeprazole, for example, is working okay, but I know that one of the concerns is that for long-term use there are some adverse side effects.
Yes, that's correct. So patients who don't want to take long-term proton pump inhibitors, such as omeprazole that you've mentioned, then yes, we do offer this procedure in lieu of those medications.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kathy. And briefly, let's talk about some of those side effects. I mean, the internet is a wonderful thing, but on the internet, everything is magnified and any anecdotal evidence you see will become fact. What, as far as you know, is the state of our knowledge as to the side effects of omeprazole or pump inhibitors?
So the popular side effect that has been explored actually over a few years now has been osteoporosis, and that does certainly, you know, having proton pump inhibitors on board in high doses, 40 milligrams a day, for twice a day, for instance, with pantoprazole, omeprazole, can increase the risk of osteoporosis to a very low percentage in some patients. The recent link to Alzheimer dementia with the beta amyloid plaques is actually a very weak study that was done. Very few patients were studied, and it showed a very, very weak link. So really what we try to advise is that if the patient truly needs these medications, they should certainly be on them. And if they don't need the medications, no, but there is no direct and strong link that has been found yet.
Dr. Sven Hida is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Bill in Gloversville. Bill, you're on.
First of all, doctor, there seems to be something wrong with your microphone. You're not coming through clearly.
Yeah. Now, thanks, Bill, for the coaching. You might want to pull that a little closer to you, doc. There we go.
How's this?
Great. All right, Bill, you're on.
Doctor, I've got two brief questions for you. I'm 62-year-old male. I had a colonoscopy with 10 polyps, and I'm wondering how much of a problem the polyps will lead to cancer. Am I doomed to developing cancer in the future? And the second question is, how important are regular bowel movements in preventing colon cancer? Should we all be taking Metamucil?
Hi, Bill. So to address the first part of your question, colon polyps are of different types. Hyperplastic, which have not been shown to develop into cancer unless they're 20 to 30 or more found in one session of a colonoscopy. And then the other ones are adenomatous polyps, which are directly linked to development of cancer. And really the genetics and a diet high in fiber or low in fiber, rather, are what are linked to colon cancer. So a diet high in fiber, like you're mentioning with Metamucil supplementation, for instance, or just a high fiber diet with raw fruits and vegetables, whole grains rather than wheat, white breads, white pastas, would decrease your chance of developing colon cancer, as well as the regular scheduled colonoscopies as advised by your gastroenterologist. And to answer the second part of your question, with the Metamucil, should we all be taking fiber supplements? That really depends on your bowel movements. So regular bowel movements or normal bowel movements are from 3 a day, ranging all the way to 3 a week. So if you don't have a change in your bowel movements, and that's what you've always had, then there's really no reason to change that in your diet. But an increasing the amount of fiber in your diet would be important and helpful to prevent the development of colon cancer.
Bill, thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551 on this Vox Pop Medical Monday. And over to line 3 and Cliff in Schenectady. Cliff, you're on.
Oh, hi. I have a question about the esophageal removal, that procedure. But the the name, the medical name for it escapes me at the moment, but my sister had esophageal cancer, and they removed her esophagus, and she unfortunately died from the radiation follow-up, the chemotherapy follow-up. And my younger brother had, he didn't have actual tumor, but he had, they call it precancerous cells in his esophagus. And so they did a preemptive. They took out his esophagus and pulled his stomach up and connected it. You know, so he lives without an esophagus, and that was a brutal operation. And that's been going on a lot. A lot of my friends have said, family members have had that same procedure. I was just wondering, suddenly I'm hearing an awful lot of stories about people having those kind of operations. Is that something that's more frequent now, or something that's always been there?
So, Cliff, first of all, I'm very sorry to hear about the passing of your sister. Secondly, to answer your question, really, with the advancement of interventional advanced endoscopy procedures, especially with endoscopic ultrasonography, any type of abnormal tissue in your esophagus, we can see throughout the entire wall of the esophagus, see how deeply this tissue invades, that it's abnormal, and may be able to offer surgical procedures through the scope, such as radiofrequency ablation, as well as endoscopic mucosal resection, which we have done for patients with cancer of the esophagus that has not spread beyond a certain thickness of the wall of the esophagus, and they did not have to lose their esophagus. But because of the acid reflux patients that have not been treated for a long time, or patients who don't come in to be examined, Barrett's esophagus, which is a precursor to cancer, has been diagnosed more and more recently. And, you know, this is something that is concerning, and patients should come in with symptoms of acid reflux and be at least checked.
Cliff, thank you very much for the call. Now, in the old days, and not so old days, you got cancer of the esophagus. It was a pretty quick death sentence. What is now the life expectancy once you are diagnosed with something like that?
So really, that depends on the stage of the cancer. Again, if a patient comes in with a biopsy diagnosis of cancer of the esophagus, adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, what we do is we do the endoscopic ultrasonography to help the surgeons and the oncologists out to be able to stage the cancer and see how advanced a stage it is. If the cancer is not an advanced stage, we can resect it fully with the scope, providing the patient a curative solution. However, if the cancer is advanced beyond that, then there are excellent surgical procedures in conjunction with chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and really patient follow-up that would give the patient an excellent chance for survival.
Dr. Sven Hida is our guest. It's a Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, featuring Deck 435, waterfront dining in the center of the Hudson Valley, where the mountains meet the Catskills, the1850house.com. New York Oncology Hematology, for over 30 years, providing comprehensive treatment of cancer and blood disorders, world-class care close to home, newyorkoncology.com. The Arthur Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, a cultural resource for the upstate region, providing a teaching, recording, and performance venue with rental options available, skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. Windy Hollow Veterinary Clinic, Montague, Massachusetts, conventional and integrative veterinary medicine, including acupuncture, comprehensive pet care, and health services since 1998, windyhollowvet.com. And from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working on land protection projects that safeguard the water quality of Lake George. Get more info, hiking maps, public events, and more at lglc.org.
It's Vox Pop, Medical Monday on WAMC. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok today. Our guest is Dr. Sven Hida, gastroenterologist at Albany Medical College. And back to the phones we go. And Jim in Matamoras. Jim, you're on.
What's your opinion on using Trikeris suis, the porcine whipworm in the treatment of chronic bowel diseases.
What's a whipworm?
Whipworm is a parasite.
Okay, Jim. So anyway, Doc, what do you think?
I'm sorry, Jim. Can you repeat the question? The use of whipworm in what?
The treatment of chronic bowel diseases.
Treatment of what diseases, sir?
Chronic bowel.
Chronic bowel diseases. It's really a topic that I'm not very familiar with as far as using parasites to treat those types of diseases. We haven't been using that recently.
No.
Mm-mm.
Whipworm. Okay. Well,
okay, thanks.
Thanks, Jim, for that one. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Over to Dave in Pittsfield. Dave, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. This is in regards to someone who was in their late 80s and early 90s. The difficulty of having a bowel movement and then finally the inability to have a bowel movement, even though stool softeners were used and soft foods were eaten, it lasted for several years. Evidently, the colon wasn't working properly. What would cause that to keep the bowels from actually coming out?
Hi, Dave. So really, in geriatric patients, elderly patients, 65 and older, who have had chronic constipation, the pelvic floor muscles of those patients tend to become weaker. And in that case, if the colon is working properly, evacuation of the stool may be a difficult task because the muscles that squeeze that last part of the gastrointestinal tract aren't working, so the patient then becomes impacted and obstructed. As far as medications, there are several types of medications. Once the determination has been made why that patient is constipated, other measures have been used, such as fiber, Kegel exercises, for instance, to strengthen the pelvic floor. Medications such as linaclotide, which is an excellent medication for chronic idiopathic constipation, and is allowing patients to move their bowels, especially in the elderly, without interfering with the kidneys, the liver. This medication is not cleared through those organs as traditional medications are, and it's an extremely safe medication for elderly.
Could polyps or hemorrhoids or anything like that keep that from happening?
No, polyps and hemorrhoids do not interfere with passage of bowel movements unless the hemorrhoids are extremely large. Yes, in which case, if they're grade 3 or 4 size hemorrhoids, those would have to be addressed either by endoscopic means or surgical means in order to allow passage of that last portion of the intestinal tract.
One doctor had mentioned that the intestines or the colon, parts of it would die off because it didn't receive blood and it was common in elderly people, and it would have to be possibly surgery to get rid of that portion that would die off due to no blood flow to it. Any sense there? Any that make any sense?
Well, Dave, that's certainly a possibility. However, it's certainly not common. Ischemia of the bowel, which means the bowel does not receive certain blood supply, usually because of atrial fibrillation or clots in a patient with heart disease, can certainly cause necrosis of portions of the bowel, but that is an extremely uncommon situation. Patients who are well hydrated, who are on aspirin, which most patients are at that age, would prevent that from happening. So that is an extremely uncommon situation.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Our guest today is Dr. Sven Hida, a board-certified gastroenterologist at Albany Medical College. And you had a residency in gerontology, right?
That's correct, yeah, at Winthrop University Hospital.
So at certain ages, I assume that there's a greater percentage of people, once they hit a certain age, maybe on, let's say, opioids, which affect that sort of bowel movement, right?
Yes, absolutely. Opioids will slow down the motion of the stool throughout the intestinal tract. Yeah.
So, is there a steady progression age wise of issues regarding digestion? In other words, if you're at 85, do you have X percentage of having Y?
So, no, one thing I've learned in gerontology is that age does not correlate with disease. But because a lot of elderly patients do tend to be on polypharmacy, not seeing geriatricians. They're seeing still their internal medicine physicians. They really don't get the proper services that they require, the proper attention, and really their metabolisms, their ability to tolerate certain medications kind of reverts to what someone would treat a pediatric patient with. You know, you have to be very careful with their livers, with their kidneys, certain medications they shouldn't be on because it affects their cognition. So really, they have to be very carefully monitored and treated just as you would a pediatric patient.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It is Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok. We're joined today by Dr. Sven Hida. And let's go to Emily in Marlboro. Emily.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Hida, I just want to ask you a question. I'm recently reading a book called The Wheat Belly. And in that book, they come from the point of view that wheat has been so technologically altered that it's no longer fit for human consumption. And that's why people have gut problems and Crohn's disease problems and gluten problems. So I was wondering if you remove wheat from the diet, which I guess is breads and pastas, have you found that that helps, you know, with people's intestine issues?
So I'm a very strong advocate for non-industrialized foods, organic foods, very clean foods. I certainly don't believe that removing wheat is something beneficial. I believe actually that's something that would not help at all, and it would create a lot more problems. What we tend to see is more allergies to medications, allergies to certain foods, autoimmune diseases that are caused by this industrialization of foods. If one were to stay away from that and try to eat organic foods, try to eat farm-grown foods that have not been altered, you would see a reduction really in a lot of these types of situations. In Europe, for instance, there's a much less instance of pancreatic cancers, celiac disease, as you mentioned. Now, wheat is a difficult material to digest for the body. It is used for patients that require higher fiber food content. It helps with constipation, obviously, especially when mixed with water. So if one was to not eat wheat anymore and other grains, barley, for instance, where gluten comes from, you certainly may feel less stomach upset at times, but the long-term effects of not eating wheat and not eating high quantity grain foods would not be a good one for sure.
Emily, thank you so much for the call. It's a Medical Monday on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Let's go to Chris in Albany. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Hida. I had a follow-up CT scan monitoring lymphoma in remission, and there was an incidental finding on the CT scan stranding of the intestines and some thickening of the bowel wall. And my oncologist didn't mention it, so I didn't notice it till I actually saw the report. I was just wondering, I don't have any diarrhea or any like obvious symptoms. They suggested it might be colitis, but I don't feel that I have those symptoms, although there might be something I'm missing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Certainly. So the features of the imaging that you've mentioned, the stranding, do indicate an inflammatory condition. Usually, if the inflammatory condition involves a large portion of the colon or the small bowel, you would be symptomatic at that point. If it's a very small part that is affected, there might be a focal inflammatory reason, whether it's the beginning of diverticulitis or perhaps something that's extraluminal or outside of the intestinal wall. So for those types of situations, I'd certainly have an endoscopic view at least to make sure that whatever is presenting on the imaging and the CAT scan is not something that is visible inside the lumen that could be biopsy diagnosed and treated, versus having an interventional procedure with endoscopy such as endoscopic ultrasonography that sees beyond the wall and is able to biopsy that area very precisely and provide you an answer.
I have diverticulosis. I've had that for a long time, so I don't know how significant this is really. I think it involves most of the bowel except for the ascending colon, but like I said, I don't have diarrhea or anything like that.
Yeah,
but you suggest a follow-up with...
Sure. Diverticulosis by itself is just the presence of these pockets in the colon. Diverticulitis is when one of them has a microperforation and causes diverticulitis. So if you could have a small spot of diverticulitis, for instance, that you are not aware of as far as no obvious symptoms, but that's most likely what is happening, yeah.
Okay. So you suggest a follow-up with GI then?
Yeah, I would certainly have a colonoscopy to take a look at that because of those findings.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chris. We appreciate it. It's Medical Monday on WAMC. Our number is 800-348-2551. And Brian in Hyde, Ron in Hyde Park. You're on with Dr. Sven Hida.
Yeah, a friend of mine contracted hep C, and then he eventually morphed into liver cancer and died about a year and a half ago. I was talking to his widow the other day, and she told me that at the end game, they were injecting really microscopic glass beads. And I was just wondering if the doctor had heard about that procedure.
So I'm sorry to hear about your friend. Unfortunately, the end stage of cirrhosis, especially caused by hepatitis C and hepatocellular carcinoma, or the liver cancer that you mentioned, when it is at that end stage, there are various treatments that can be administered to delay the progression of that cancer. Some of those include the placement of fiducials or radioactive beads, as you mentioned, in order to kill off blood vessels that continue to feed the tumors and also destroy the tumors themselves to try to prevent the rapid progression.
Great. Thank you very much.
So is that the end game? In other words, it's too late to do much else at that point?
Yeah, when you have liver cancer, whether it's hepatitis B, which is the most frequent cause of it, or hepatitis C, at liver cancer diagnosis, if it's just one or two tumors, really, they can be surgically removed with very good outcomes. However, if it is metastatic and has spread out wide, then that's terminal at that point.
Dr. Sven Hida is our guest on this Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Chartok today. And Monica in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Yes, hi, doctor. I had an episode recently of severe acid reflux that woke me up in the middle of the night. I knew it was reflux. I took some Mylanta. It just continued to get worse. I got pale and diaphoretic and very weak. I went to the emergency room, and they were able to give me some things to calm it down a bit. And I did have an upper GI recently. All the doctor told me was that there were some areas of irritation. But the question he didn't answer, and I'm hoping you can answer, is it unusual to have such an isolated, severe episode? And should I really continue the pantoprazole, or is it safe to go off of it?
Well, for your types of symptoms, it is unusual to have such an intense symptom. Certainly, patients do wake up in the middle of the night with them, but for you to get diaphoretic, pale, indicates that there might be gallbladder involvement. So I certainly would have an endoscopic ultrasound and perhaps a HIDA scan to measure the ejection fraction of the gallbladder and make sure that the gallbladder is not diseased, that there's no issues with the gallbladder itself. When you mentioned that you had an upper GI, you mean an endoscopy or an upper GI series?
Yes. Yes, an endoscopy.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. So as long as you've had the endoscopy, certainly there's a way to look at the tissue there and make sure that you're not in trouble as far as that's concerned. But the gallbladder would be something that I would look at next, as well as bile reflux.
Okay, thank you.
So the gallbladder will mimic, the gallbladder issues will mimic reflux?
Yes, absolutely. Gallbladder disease, like biliary dyskinesia, for instance, or obstruction of the gallbladder neck, certainly can cause epigastric pain, as you would have with heartburn, and it would mimic a lot of the symptoms of acid reflux, yeah.
So what percentage of the population has their gallbladder removed?
It's actually skewed more toward women, especially after they've had children, certain patients taking medications. I would say a pretty good percentage, about 20%.
Really?
Say. Absolutely.
20%?
Yeah.
And so once you have that gallbladder taken out, you can't eat certain things, or is that a myth?
Well, once the gallbladder is taken out, the reservoir for bile, which is used in digestion of fat, is removed. And what happens after that is the Gammon bile duct serves as that reservoir, and it does dilate a little bit. So what you can't do is you can't have a very large fatty meal at once that would cause stomach upset, nausea, vomiting, and perhaps diarrhea.
Oh, boy. What about booze?
As a physician, I can't really give you that
right.
Of,
advice. Thank you. You didn't fall into the trap. Well done. Rick in Westbrook. Rick, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. Doctor, I'm a patient of, let's see, I've had a few procedures done at one time, not quite a year ago, but I had an endoscopy, you know, it's like, I guess it was down the throat, what have you. Inspect my stomach walls and all whatever else was going on. The doctor took a clipping of a small polyp. It was biopsied. found to have no cancer, you know, whatsoever. Also, with the colonoscopy, all right, they did their scraping, what they had to do there, found no cancerous problems there or whatever. But my problem is this, since that procedure, and I don't know, I have another question beyond this, but since that procedure, I've had continuous, like, early morning, consistent having to have, you know, it's all loose bowel movements. And I don't know if that had something to do with clipping the polyp in the stomach or something else, because I never had that before the procedure. And after the procedure of the endoscopy, where they went down into my stomach and everything, the ovum, is that the little piece hangs in the back of your throat?
The uvula, yes.
Ovula, okay, I'm sorry. Anyway, but that, I've had three episodes with that where it's swole to a size where I found myself having problems breathing and not being able to even go to sleep because it swelled to the size of a quarter and closed off my airway, so I had to kind of stay awake and drink cold water and cold drinks or whatever to try to subdue the swelling. Is that normal?
So, no, we don't.
I've never had that before the procedures, and I've had that, all of this that I've just described to you, since the procedures, and this was less than a year ago.
No, I certainly understand that. Usually, it's not a very common situation to have irritation of the uvula after upper endoscopy. The uvula can be irritated after an upper endoscopy. Usually, the irritation from that only lasts about a day or so. If there's continued
during
irritation.
During that course of time, but during that course of time, if I fall asleep and put my head back, I have to wake up. I've had, you know, sleep apnea before over the years, but it had nothing to do with anything swollen in my throat. It was just my airways. But I take, you know, meds and you know, inhalers for that, and everything's fine other than when this piece in the back of my throat does swell up, and it's happened three times in the past year, and I never had that before in my life. So I figured, is it related, or do I have another problem to, you know, consult with my physicians? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's certainly, I would say it's not related. I would recommend that you are seen by an ear, nose, and throat physician that can evaluate that area more carefully and, you know, look at a possible differential diagnosis that would include infectious disease as well.
All right, because when they put a tube down your throat, and I don't know, I didn't see the tube, but I figure it's probably corrugated, you know, and I'm figuring the rippling of that corrugation going down. And I was told I had a little bit of distress in breathing while I was under, you know, while I was under, put it that way. And I'm figuring, did that annoy it enough? Or, like you said, I have to see an ENT for this? Or
I would certainly see an ENT because although those instruments are not corrugated and they are pretty smooth and there is surgical jelly that's used to use them, even if they would have caused irritation, that irritation would not have lasted more than a couple of days after the procedure.
Thank you very much for that call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Our guest, Dr. Sven Hida, and we'll hit the home stretch on a Vox Pop Medical Monday in a moment.
Support comes from Claire Pearson, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, for 14 years offering plant spirit medicine and energy clearing for health, body, mind, and spirit. CLAREPearson.net. NBT Bank offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in Makoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement. For early to mid-stage osteoarthritis, healthquest.org/ortho. Interim Healthcare, for 45 years, working to help people age in place. Companion aides and nurses, 7 days a week, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga. InterimHealthcare.com. And from the New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, celebrating 35 years, serving the public. 800-342-3661.
Oh, you know, this lockbox at WAMC.org, it's going like gangbusters. Almost $220,000 raised as of a few moments ago. And, you know, fund drive is coming. 2 weeks from today, we'll be in the middle of the fund drive. And every dollar we raised in the lockbox now helps us shorten the drive. And our dear friend Jane Kane not Jane Keane from the Honeymooners. Jane Kane will give us $10,000 if we can raise $400,000 in the lockbox by the first day of the fund drive. So we are $180,000 to go. It's a lot of money, but you guys are doing great. WAMC.org. We still have tickets to see the Capitol Steps at the Egg, a pair of those for a $125 pledge or more, and they're going fast. It's November 18th at the Egg, one of the first shows the Capitol Steps will do after the election. I'm sure they'll have some hilarious things to say. WAMC.org, feed the lockbox. It is Medical Monday, and Dr. Sven Hida, first time on the program, doing very well. Has it met your expectations? Or are you dissatisfied with the program?
No, I'm having fun with it.
Really?
Absolutely.
Good for you. Well, there's a first for everything. All right, let's go back to the phones. And Mary and Colony, you're on, Mary.
Hi. My question is, what pertains to, my husband is having an endoscopy tomorrow morning. And his symptoms have been, he's been, since I've known him, coughing. He has this terrible cough, and it's gotten worse. And he finally realized that he was having a problem swallowing, I forget, a few months back. And he feels that when he swallows, there's like this section in his chest that's, or his esophagus, that is not letting food pass through. And he told me yesterday or this morning that he was drinking water, and all of a sudden he would hear it trickling through, and almost like there was like all of a sudden an opening and it went. My question is that I should let you also know that he has been taken naproxenium sodium because he has arthritis, and I'm trying to figure out what we might see tomorrow. I know that we don't have it in front of us, but I was just trying to think of what be possibilities that could come or could arise.
So, Mary, cough is an atypical symptom of acid reflux. It certainly does happen because of acid vapors that rise up through the esophagus and loosen up the sinuses, causing a postnasal drip and irritation of the back of the throat with cough. So if this is indeed related to acid reflux that has been happening for a long term, then you may see some inflammation of the esophagus. You may see irritation, ulceration, especially with the use of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication naproxen that you've mentioned. So you may see some ulcerations. You may see some inflammation. Hopefully you won't see anything too much more than that.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Over to line eight, and Linda in Lake George. Linda, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
I've had problems with constant diarrhea. It's constant, and it seems to I seem to be having problems swallowing and having diarrhea at the same time. So, like, if I can't eat anything because I'm spitting it up, and if I do manage to get something down, then I'm having diarrhea. I expect myself to be emaciated and dead or something, but I think all the sugar and the pre-made tea I drink is probably the thing that's keeping me alive at this point. I'm really tired of both symptoms. I can be sound asleep in the middle of the night, and I lose my breath, and I wake right up, and I'm gasping for air. It happens sometimes when I start coughing, something feels like it's blocking off in my swallowing, and I'm gasping for air. And at the other end, it's like, I guess maybe five times since last year at this same date to right now, I've had maybe five normal bowel movements. It's constant diarrhea no matter what I eat. I've been to the local doctors, and I want to know what's the difference between a laparoscopic operation and the scalpel operation, so I can justify to my holistic medicine general practitioner why I want to go down to Albany and see you versus staying here and seeing the guys here. Did I wrap that up enough for you to understand?
Sure, Linda. So I'm sorry. It sounds like you've been having quite a lot to deal with, and I'm happy that you're with us. I'm sure it is. Now, I'm not really sure why you would have surgery. It sounds to me that you'd have to have an endoscopy and a colonoscopy at the beginning to try to figure out what the issues are that are causing you these symptoms. As far as laparoscopic versus an open, as you refer to it, a scalpel procedure, really is a very invasive procedure, and I'm not really sure what you would have that for the symptoms that you've described. Endoscopy and colonoscopy.
Oh, I forgot to throw in the fact that I have internal hemorrhoids.
Yeah, even internal hemorrhoids, those are something that certainly can be dealt with endoscopically without invasive laparoscopic surgery or scalpel surgery.
Okay.
Certainly. So an upper endoscopy and a colonoscopy would be the way to start to get a diagnosis and really kind of a follow up after that.
Thank you, Linda.
Could I get your number to Albany Med so I can call and make an appointment?
We can give the number out for Albany Med if you have it on hand. If not, we'll put it on the webpage.
Yes, absolutely.
Always look at that. He's got a card. I'll be darned. That's amazing.
So you could call our office at 518 area code 262-5276, and we'd be happy to see you.
All right. Linda, thank you so much.
76. And thank you, guys.
I appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Over to Beverly in Hinsdale. Beverly, you're on.
Hi. I had a question about acid reflux. I had an endoscopy about 3 years ago, and I had a barium swallow probably about 2 years ago. And after coming out of there, they said that I had silent reflux. And I was just wondering, I'm on 20 milligrams of omeprazole twice a day. And if I'm changing my diet, which, you know, a big learning process for me, but how do I take care of something that I don't even feel coming up?
So that's an excellent question. The way to go about that, silent reflux really refers to reflux without symptoms. And if you've had endoscopic work that showed irritation of the esophagus because of acid or bile reflux, the changes in diet would be the most important. Low-fat diet, low-carbohydrate, as far as simple sugars, would be the most important because fat tends to stick to the stomach walls and it tends to keep that lower esophageal sphincter open, allowing reflux. Also, not eating if you were going to lie down right away. I would wait at least 2 to 3 hours before lying down after eating your meals. But that would be the way to, you know, lifestyle modifications. There are other alternative homeopathic ways of treating acid reflux, such as sodium bicarbonate, which is baking soda. You would take about a teaspoon or two of those of that, mix it with water 3 times a day. That would be the equivalent of the omeprazole. And then you could have endoscopic work again after 6 months to a year to see if those changes have resulted in your amelioration of your condition.
Okay, so if I go with a teaspoon of baking soda 3 times a day, is that in conjunction with for a while I wean myself off the omeprazole?
No, it would be in lieu of the omeprazole. You would take that with water about 3 times a day. It's a natural buffer that your body uses already to buffer its acid.
It just changes the pH?
It changes the pH, exactly.
All right, Beverly, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Weight loss is a big thing with reducing reflux too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Weight loss, diabetes, there are so many disease states that are linked to obesity. And hopefully in the very near future, we'll be offering sleeve procedures as well, endoscopically without open surgery.
Now, how could you do that without cutting?
Well, because there are many techniques and tools that are available now, such as the Apollo overstitch, and this is something that we can very easily use to create that sleeve in the stomach. It's a 45-minute procedure. It still requires the patient to have behavioral modification and follow-up that's very close. However, there are no external incisions.
So you create the sleeve is like origami? How do you do that?
Endoscopically, yes. We mark the areas of the stomach that we are going to approximate, and then with the stitch, it is a stitch, a needle and stitch, but we do this all through the mouth inside
Amazing.
The stomach.
Amazing. All right, let's go back to the phones. Jim in Albany. Jim, you're on.
Hey, thank you for the good program.
Thank you.
My question is about acid reflux and whether it helps to be sitting up and sleeping in that position.
So, no, that certainly would be very uncomfortable. what I would recommend for that is certainly to have an upper endoscopy if you haven't had one yet, to make sure that there are no issues with swallowing and with the lower esophageal sphincter as far as it's being able to close properly.
No, it's not me. My aunt had the problem, and it helped her to sleep in a sitting position or reclining, you know, maybe 10 or 20 degrees.
Well, so
there's, she was about 90 years old.
Yeah. Well, God bless her. There are certain things. There's certain things such as.
God bless you too, doctor. This is a great program.
Oh, thank you, sir. I appreciate that. If there is a problem with movement of the food from the stomach into the small intestine, which is a motility disorder, that certainly can also be addressed if a patient has that, for instance. If not, not eating. For at least 3 hours after going to or lying down 3 hours after you've eaten your last meal is also something that's very important to prevent acid reflux without having to sleep in that sitting position.
Thank you very much.
Jim, thanks a lot. Now, you know, I'm no doctor, but it would seem to me that gravity being what it is, sitting up, sleeping would reduce the acid coming back up the esophagus. Am I wrong?
Well, no, certainly you're not wrong, but the acid in the stomach really is there to process the food that's in the stomach. If the stomach has already processed the food and passed it through to the small intestine, there really shouldn't be acid pooling up in the stomach. It really is a response to food being there. So once that food has passed to the small intestine, there shouldn't be anything to reflux.
Okay, let's go back to the phones, get a few more in here before the end of the program. Henry in New Paltz. Henry, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Doctor, back in February, I developed a case of diarrhea which didn't go away after I tried different changes in my diet, so on and so forth. I went to see my doctor on May 23rd. I had gotten married the week before and presented with the diarrhea. He did various tests for parasites, so on and so forth. I had a colonoscopy. They found 4 polyps. None of them tested to be cancerous. So I went to ultrasound. With the ultrasound, they found cancer in my liver. And then they checked my lung. They found cancer in my lung. So I'm stage 4 with cancer in my lung and cancer in my liver. The diarrhea has not, except for one day right after chemotherapy, and I think it was the steroids, I don't know. I had one correct bowel movement one day since February up until this point. I have to get up every hour, every 2 hours to use the bathroom, which is tiring. Now, my other question, number one question is the diarrhea. Number two, concerning the diarrhea and the chemotherapy, I wanted to know if there's any food that would directly render the chemotherapy non-effective. Either the doctor told me to eat 3 to 6 smaller meals of a healthy diet, which to me is fresh vegetables and fruit. I don't eat red meat very, very much. The diarrhea never went away. I saw a dietitian with my last round of chemo, and she flipped things right around. I was told not to eat fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, no high fiber kind of stuff, and she just twisted things around, flipped things, so to speak, in my mind. I don't drink coffee daily as I used to. I have maybe 2 cups a week now.
Okay. Henry, we're almost out of time here. We got to let the doc talk here. We're almost done.
Thank you.
Sure. No problem, Henry. So to answer your first part of your question, sometimes certain types of cancers, carcinoid tumors and things like that certainly can be involved in the generation of diarrhea. However, also the chemotherapy treatments can cause diarrhea by causing inflammation of the colon and causing the colon not to be able to absorb the water that it's supposed to absorb and to result in normal solid bowel movements. So as far as your nutritionist or your dietitian is concerned, she is correct. You do not want to use any types of foods like high fiber foods, for instance, to help your diarrhea because it wouldn't in your case. In your case, because of the inflammation of the colon, those would just make the diarrhea worse. So what you'd want to do at that point is you'd want to use medications such as Benefibo or Metamucil without drinking additional water to allow those to increase the bulk of your stools, as well as certain medications that would slow down the transit of the food through your intestinal tract and allow the colon more time to absorb that water.
Henry, thanks a lot for that. Okay, we only have about a minute or so here, so let's try to blast through an email, Doc. This one came in from Jill in New Windsor. I'm a 65-year-old woman who was diagnosed with mild gastroparesis following a stomach emptying test. I didn't want to take Reglan because of the black box warning, so my doctor has had me on erythromycin for the last 2 years. Now I am experiencing heart palpitations and arrhythmia due to the erythromycin. Can you recommend any OTC aids to digestion that might help this? And that's from Jill.
So, Jill, over-the-counter medications tend to do very poorly with gastroparesis. What I would recommend is a high-fiber diet and plenty of water, at least 2 liters a day, to attempt to correct your gastroparesis, as well as find out what the underlying reason for your gastroparesis is. If it's diabetes, for instance, then the blood glucose should be very kept under very tight control. There is another medication called domperidone, which is made in compounding pharmacies. It works just like Reglan without the black box warning for tardive dyskinesia and the holiday that you would have to take from erythromycin.
Well, you made it through the whole show, Doctor.
Well
done. You can rest easy now. It's all finished. It's all behind you now. Once again, the lockbox, WAMC.org. We are at about $180,000 to go, and if we can hit the $400,000 mark by the beginning of our fund drive, October 17th, we'll get an extra $10,000 from our friend Jane Kane. So WAMC.org, feed that lockbox. Thanks for listening to the show today. Thanks to Dr. Sven Hida for joining us. Support comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, announcing new primary care center on Main Street, Fonda, opening in 2017, NLH.org. Thanks again to Dr. Hida for being here. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Splendid service at the controls. Your phones were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is myself. I'm Ray Graff. Stay tuned now for news.